Group Meeting, Saturday, 10th May, 1986. We have completed 3 chapters so far, and this 4th chapter is titled The Injunction and the Mandate. At first sight, the gates are barred. Sri Rama says to Hanuman, never should the Upanishads be imparted to an atheist, an ungrateful person, one intent on vicious actions, one having no devotion to me, or one who loses his way in the cave of books. On no account should they be given to one devoid of devotion. This comes from the Muktiko Upanishad. That means the Liberation Upanishad, Mukti. The sage Shvetashvatara says, Shvetashvatara was the teacher who first introduced the idea, the monotheistic idea of a supreme being. And he talked considerably in terms of God as an individual creator God. This highest mystery in the Vedanta, which has been declared in a former age, should not be given to one whose passions are not subdued, nor again to one who is not a son or a pupil. Now here, the word son needs a little explanation. You find, for instance, in the Old Testament, there are so many references. Take, for example, the second book of Kings, when Elijah and Elisha go on that journey. There were 50 sons of the prophets waiting at the end of the journey. Now, prophets don't have 50 sons of the flesh. They would find it rather expensive. A son of the prophet really stands for the foremost disciple or disciples. For instance, the Buddha says on one occasion to his bhikkhus, bhikkhus, I am a Brahman. You are the sons of my mouth. Very interestingly put, the relationship is as intimate as that between teacher and pupil. In ancient India, and of course in the ancient world as a whole, the eldest son was regarded with considerable affection. You know the Jewish custom. If a man had 4 or 5 sons, the eldest one received twice as much legacy as each of the other sons. The other son, the amount was divided equally between the other sons, but the eldest son had twice as much. It was a very intimate relationship. And this was a spiritual relationship wherein most of the teaching was given through what I have called spiritual induction. As and when you progress with the religious life and develop your powers of meditation in the real sense, then it becomes possible for two people who have so developed in that way, to sit together, and without saying a word, they can commune with each other. You see, this is because they are able to enter that state of consciousness which functions in terms of infinity and eternity. The Buddha actually gave out the hint in the way he categorized the different states of meditation. To me it is a matter of great surprise that no one seems to have cottoned on to it and expounded it properly. The Buddha says, for instance, he then enters upon and abides in the consciousness of infinity, and then the infinity of akasha, akasha meaning not just sky or space as ordinarily translated, but akasha meaning that void which holds the plenitude as a potentiality, that means the manifested universe. And the next stage is where he enters upon and abides in the infinity of consciousness. And the infinity of consciousness is associated with time, because we are conscious in our consciousness functions in those two special ways, in terms of space and time. Space is the container, if you like. And time is, time means that you are aware of the succession of events, because that's what time tells you particularly, isn't it? The succession of events throughout the day, throughout the year, throughout the lifetime, and so forth. So he actually propounded the ideas of infinity and eternity in terms of the consciousness of the Holy One. So now, a son of the teacher was one who had advanced far enough to be the successor of the teacher when the teacher died. You know how in that Elisha story, at the last stage, when they leave Jericho, the place of fragrance. Place of fragrance means the place of the holy life and its significance in your own inner consciousness, which is so fragrant. You have in the Christian Mass, for example, the statement, the sweet savor of a holy life. You see? But I'm afraid our padres don't quite penetrate that far. This place of fragrance is one but the last stage, so to say. The fourth one is the arrival at Jordan, the parting of the ways, when no longer it is a case of the teacher leading or drawing out, inducting the pupil to the profounder and profounder states of consciousness. But the teacher will disappear. You see, you are your own best teacher. And your psychophysical organism, the body, in relation to which you use the word I, and you use the word you in relation to every other psychophysical organism. This psychophysical organism provides the way to human fulfillment. It provides the way, and it is also the teacher, assuming that you know, you are able to pay proper and perfect attention to it. The ordinary techniques of meditation, you see, they are all child's play really. They don't take you very far. But if you can really appreciate what their objective is, you will see that there are ways and means to enable you to pay perfect attention to the Supreme Teacher, which is yourself. You know how in the yoga system, it is said, Kundalini yoga system, it is said that when you arrive at Vishuddhi, the throat chakra, you hear the voice of the teacher. The teacher that is within you yourself, the embodied transcendence. You see? So, it is that sort of thing to which these people refer. Of course, I say so. Somebody else may say that I'm talking through my hat, that I've got a rather bright imagination, and these are imaginings, but I can tell you they are not imaginings. The seer Shakayanya says to King Brihadratha, "Let no one declare this most secret doctrine to anyone who is not a son, who is not a pupil, who is not of a tranquil mind." Now, again, a tranquil mind, it doesn't mean that he is just inwardly at peace within himself in the ordinary way. All of us have experienced, time and again probably, occasions when we felt very quiet and peaceful. But if you can pay perfect attention to what the psychophysical organism is doing or what is happening to it, you will see that the mind is not tranquil, because the brain is chattering away 100 to the dozen. It just will not stop chattering. Monkeys are nowhere near it. They can't chatter like we can chatter. You see, but when that chatter calms down, and it calms down by itself, you can't strive to obtain it. Do remember that. You have to be in the mood of expectation. Just looking, what's going to happen now, you see? Without ever being told that such and such a thing is going to happen. Now, for instance, you just said to me that, before we started here, that Horowitz is giving a recital on the first Sunday in June. Now, if I go to hear Horowitz, and if I can be perfectly calm where the noise and chatter of all those collected there has ceased, in my brain, and my brain is not chattering back, I am still expecting Horowitz to appear on the platform at any moment. You see, that very expectation is the absence of tranquility. You see, yoga is more difficult than composing the B minor mass. Far more difficult. This tranquility, this calming down of the noise of the universe, which goes on inside everybody's skull in the brain, it is the most tremendous and most difficult thing to do. But don't struggle to do it. That is the important point. Just watch it. Watch the noise. Listen to that noise. But don't listen wanting to listen for something which will be useful to you. You see what I mean? there must be no expectation, no desire, no longing involved in it. It must be allowed to happen. This is the most difficult thing for us members of the species Homo sapiens. This is our Homo stultus side. You see? Just allow it to happen. Don't care about achieving or attaining anything. This is the difficulty. When you take to yoga, for instance, examine yourself. Examine yourself very critically, not harshly, not self-indulgently, but just observe. This is what it is. And you will discover exactly what it is. In that discovery is the healing of the psyche. You don't need a teacher, you don't need a psychologist, a psychiatrist or anybody at all. Just be quiet. It is so difficult that one could almost use slang and say it's damned difficult. So now, who is not of a tranquil mind? Now, Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, never is this to be spoken by thee to anyone who is without austerity, nor to one without devotion, nor to one who desireth not to listen, nor yet to him who speaketh ill of me. Not to be spoken to anyone who is without austerity. Now don't run away practicing austerities, severe austerities. The Buddha tried that out. You read some of those discourses in the middle length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya. You get a full account of all the terrible, horrible austerities he went to. And it took him nowhere, excepting to bring the body almost to the verge of death. You see? And then there came the change when he saw that they were utterly useless. The deathless state was not available through the austerities. The deathless state being one in which consciousness is free from the successive things that captivate consciousness. It's this successiveness, the reincarnation, so to say, of one thing in your mind, the next thing in your mind, the next thing in your mind. That's the only real meaning of reincarnation. Because we associate I, the self, with each of those things. There is no other meaning to reincarnation. That some identifiable entity which is eternal will come back again and again in another psychophysical organism is sheer nonsense. This is the rebirth. The Buddha, for instance, constantly uses the term, this sort of language. He says, so that there is no substrate for rebirth. And if you examine the context in which he says those things, you will see that what he is referring to actually is this association with a permanent I, with a new state of mind. That is all. You know, Ananda Kumara Swami, he was a real genius, that man. I got the phrase from him, the Lord is the only transmigrant. It's the totality which transmigrates from split second to split second through the entire universal process. Just as you and I, as particular individuals, forming an integral part and parcel of that totality, experience rebirth, reincarnation in our own mind from moment to moment. It flits. When that gets stilled, absolutely still, then that is nirvana. That is the kingdom of heaven, the peace that passes understanding. It is a state of inaction on the part of the organism wherein your total being actually is active in eternity. Action in eternity by consciousness takes place then. So, not to be spoken to anyone who is without austerity. So, what is austerity? Austerity is the refraining from anything that is unnecessary for fulfillment. That is the true meaning of asceticism. The Greek word ascesis means precisely that, to abstain from the unnecessary. It's, for example, supposing I get a little burn or something, you see, and there's a scab forming afterwards, isn't there? In due time, the scab falls off. Let all that is unnecessary naturally fall off. Don't try to pluck it off. It has a lesson for you. Because the scabs in our psyche are the result of our own greed, hate, delusion, fear, suspicion, and so on. You see? Watch them. Watch the process. The process of healing will take place in the psyche, just as in the body itself, all our cells have this extraordinary faculty of self-healing. The living cell is self-motivating, self-reproducing, and self-healing. But you see, because this is all inherent in our very existence, we must let it happen. All very well for me to talk like that, because only the other day there was something on my skin and I just did that with it and brushed it off. Life is funny. Nor to one without devotion. Devotion is so important. It comes. Devotion does not mean all this pious gesticulating in a church or temple or whatever it is. Devotion is a state of heart which is capable of total giving of oneself to what is the worthwhile. The transcendentally worthy. Jesus says in his Sermon on the Mount, "Give not that which is holy unto the dogs." He certainly didn't refrain from using strong language. "Neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet, and turn again and rend you." How true it was in his case. Dionysius the Areopagite writes, "And I pray, let no uninitiated person approach the sight of truth. For neither is it without danger to gaze upon the glorious rays of the sun with weak eyes, nor is it without peril to put our hands to things above us." That which is above and beyond will take us up of its own. When we are ready, when the psyche is purified, when the heart is truly aflame with devotion, a quiet love for the Supreme, then the Supreme takes us up. The Supreme realizes its own transcendence through us. You will notice that the great teachers, the truly great teachers, never said, "I have realized transcendence." Because the very word "I" is something which separates the psychophysical organism, to which alone you can refer to as I. It separates that from the totality. And wheresoever there is a separation from the totality, one is in a state of sin. That is the meaning of the word sin. Whatsoever hurts or tries to disturb or break the unity of the universe is sin. That's its fundamental meaning. I forget now from what European language it comes originally, but that's how it is. That comes in his book on the ecclesiastical hierarchy. Then from the Mystical Theology, chapter 1. "These things thou must not disclose to any of the uninitiated, by whom I mean," now listen very carefully, "those who cling to the objects of human thought." Those are the uninitiated ones. "Those who cling to the objects of human thought, desire," and so on. You see? "So I want to become Prime Minister," etc., etc., etc. You see? "And imagine there is no..." And they, and these people, the uninitiated, are those who imagine there is no super essential reality beyond, and fancy that they know by human understanding him that has made darkness his secret place. It was either Eckhart or Tauler, one of those two Christian mystics, who spoke of the divine dark and the desert of the Godhead. You see, that him that has made darkness his secret place. Because you can't see in the dark. Then there is a long one, quotation from the prologue to the Cloud of Unknowing. I'll perhaps omit that. It's rather long. Then, from the Supreme Path, the Rosary of Precious Gems of the Tibetan Master Gampopa of the Kagyupta sect. "The perfect wisdom, having been found within oneself in virtue of the teacher's grace, it would be a cause of regret to dissipate it amidst the jungle of worldliness. to sell like so much merchandise the sublime doctrine of the sages would be a cause of regret. This comes in a little, there are numbers 7 and 8 of a little writing called The 10 Causes of Regret. Supreme teachers laid down the injunction. The heart of religion was to be withheld from the vicious, the ungrateful, the unsubdued, from those without devotion, austerity, tranquility, from dogs and swine, from those who were not sons or pupils, from the curious, and from both the lettered and the unlettered. Who then were those worthy to receive the teaching? Sri Rama says to Hanuman, O Maruti, which is one of the names of Hanuman, it is only after thorough testing that the Upanishads should be imparted to a disciple giving service to his teacher, to a well-disposed son, or to one devoted to me, following good observances, belonging to a good family, and being of good intelligence. Whoever studies or hears the 108 Upanishads attains me, the supreme state. Sakayanya says to Brihadratha, to one who is devoted to none other than his teacher, to one endowed with all good qualities, one may give it. And from the prologue to the cloud of unknowing, this is the mandate. These are the mandates, you see. If it be to those men the which, of course this is in this old-fashioned English, although they stand in activity by outward form of living, nevertheless, yet by inward striving after the privy spirit of God, whose dooms, whose declarations be hid, they be full graciously disposed, not continually, as is proper to very contemplatives, but now and then to be perceivers in the highest point of this contemplative act, if such men might see it, they should, by the grace of God, be greatly comforted thereby. In short, again, to use a slightly slang way, give it only to the goodies. Out of compassion, the truth is withheld, because the truth sears. It sears all, but whereas the searing moves the unfit to evil and to spreading destruction, it purifies and heals the worthy one. Out of reverence and love for the truth, it is withheld, for truth is a tender flower. How easily its beauty is shattered when the organizer congeals it into an inflexible, rigid doctrine. How easily its fragrance is lost in the incense of the rituals and the smoke of the crude fantasies of the conventionally pious. The truth is hidden. One, the Holy of Holies in the temple is an empty space, the void, which is the unknown mystery whence flash forth appearances, gods, angels, or oracles, whatever you will.